So, hello everyone. Welcome to day two of this workshop on Tensor Networks from Simulations to Holography. My name is Sukhi Singh, and I'll be taking you through the program today. We have an exciting lineup of speakers. We'll start with Ignacio Serac, followed by Michael Walter, and we'll end the day with Steve White. In addition to these three talks, we also have a special session devoted to student presentations today. So these are meant to be short presentations. I think there are four 10-minute presentations. You can find more details in the schedule. So please enjoy today's program and participate and ask questions. And remember, if you can't be bothered to unmute yourself and ask a question, you can always type it in the chat window, and I'll be happy to read out your question to the speaker at an appropriate time. Having said that, Ignacio has requested that all questions be postponed to the end of the talk, so you can at least continue. You can at least post your question in the chat, and I'll probably read them out at the end of the talk. So without further ado, it's a great pleasure to welcome today's first speaker. That's Ignacio Serac from the Max Planck Institute of Quantum Optics. And today he'll be talking about quantum cellular automata and what they have to do with tensor networks. So Ignacio, thanks a lot for giving this talk. And please, the screen is all yours.
Thank you very much, Sukhi. It's a great pleasure to be here presenting some work that we have been doing during the last months. And it's about tensor networks, but in connection to unitary operations. It's very much related to quantum circuit, how you represent quantum circuits with tensor networks, which goes beyond that, as you will see. And I have to say that that's a very theoretical work. So, I mean, they're not numerical results. This, I mean, we, as you know, so I'm here in at MPQ work on tensor networks very heavily, and in particular in developing methods and using these methods to describe many body systems, but also we try to lay down a theory for tensor networks. And this talk is about the second part. So it's a theoretical, very theoretical work. So maybe it's a little bit technical as well. Anyway, the co-workers, I would like to present Lorenzo Piroli. He's a postdoc in my group. And so he is responsible for most of the things that I'm going to say here. And I will briefly mention some other ongoing work together with Giorgio Stiriaris and some previous work with Song Ping Gong and Christoph Sunderhoff. Both of them, all three are also at MPQ. And also I would say that this program of developing the theory of tensor networks and describing anything we can with tensor networks, it's a long-standing project for that I started many years ago together with David Perez Garcia, Noigo Shuh, and Frank Fischtrate. Okay, so I guess that everybody has knows what a cellular automata, what cellular automata are, and that's something that is classically is and is defined by the set of simple local rules. So this means you have a lattice, then at each of the lattice, you define how this will evolve in the next step just by looking at what is at the moment at this lattice points and what is the surrounding, and then you do a step and you put several of these simple local rules, and many complex phenomena can appear. And so that's one example, the Conway's game of life, in which, I mean, you see how populations grow, they meet together, then some die and so on. So very simple local rules give rise to complex phenomena in classical, let's say, dynamics. So for many years, people tried to do the same thing for quantum cellular automata to define what are quantum cellular automata. However, I mean, some problems in trying to translate these classical cellular automata to quantum systems were found. And also there were many options. And also there were connections not only to the classical cellular automata, but also to the theory of computation, also to quantum computing, and so on. And somehow a little bit the fact that there are many connections and many descriptions stems from the fact that, I mean, a natural definition of quantum cellular automata should be, first of all, compatible with classical cellular automata, so it should include classical cellular automata in a sense. Second, it should obey the rules of quantum physics. However, this seems to be a little bit in contrast with the first law that I mentioned, because for unitary operations, then sometimes it's difficult to describe a classical cellular automata, because unitary operations are reversible, whereas, I mean, quantum cellular automata, the loss that you produce there may not be reversible, this local loss. Actually, for now, I mean, I'll explain it a little bit, but for unitary operators, so when the evolution is unitary of the whole system, then there exists, I think, an accepted definition for quantum cellular automata, and I'll talk about that. However, for general actions, so when you have channels where you can have dissipation, where your system is coupled to an environment, that's more complicated. And actually, that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about quantum cellular automata, both for unitary, but also general actions. And I would like to define them in terms of causality and locality. So I will explain that, what I mean by that. And then show that actually, with these definitions, then it turns out that quantum cellular automata and their extensions to, let's say, quantum non-unitary evolution are connected to tensor networks. So in fact, I will show that, I mean, any quantum cellular automata can be described in terms of tensor networks in an efficient way. And this automatically implies that this quantum cellular automata fulfill a set of area laws for the mutual information, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And also shows that this, with these definitions that I will do, then one can make a classification of now quantum cellular automata without dissipation. And as we will see, I mean, some concepts which appear that are actually seem very intriguing. So for example, the possibility of having, let's say, quantum channels that produce topological order, or that are different than some other ones that don't produce topological order, but they cannot be described locally, and so on. So I want to talk a little bit about that as well. So as I mentioned, so most of the work is in this paper here, except for this last one, that's an ongoing project. Okay, so let me start here talking about quantum cellular automata, going a little bit back in history. So I think actually are provide universal classical computation. And so, I mean, it's very much related to
Turing machine, for example.
So you can define a Turing machine in a way like a cellular automata, and this gives rise to universal computation. So they were trying to define a universal quantum computation, and this is why they were interested in defining through cellular automata. They had some definitions. Grossing and Zannige introduced another definition, but I don't know if they were completely satisfactory. And Walthrus then, I mean, connected to the field of quantum computing, and then had a definition, because in the way in the field of classical computation, so cellular automata are also very natural in terms of random walks, and it has been shown that certain algorithms can be speed up if you have some algorithm based on the some method based on random walks. And so people studied then if quantum algorithms could also use this kind of quantum cellular automata, and that's what the work went. At the same time, in different direction, Richter and Werner tried to define this quantum cellular automata, just quantizing the classical cellular automata that give rise to this life game that I showed at the beginning. And there were several attempts, and I think that when they gave a good definition and it was established, was in this paper here, and somehow in this paper as well. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But let me just mention that quantum cellular automata is not the same thing as a random walk. So a random walk or a quantum random walk is a single particle. So you have like a lattice, and then there is a single particle that can go to the right or to the left with certain probability according to some rules, but that's for a single particle. And for random walks, actually, it's very easy to so it will be like a quantum cellular automata with a single particle. There is just a single particle that moves. And this can be quantized, and there have been many papers on what people call quantum random walks, and in which the idea is that you basically, in order to make the evolution unitary, then you have to basically toss a coin, and if it's right, then you move to the right. If it's heads up, you move to the right. If it's tails up, then you move to the left. And in order to keep unitarity, then you have to keep the coin such that you can also have superpositions. And in fact, there has been a lot of theoretical work and experimental work and the use of quantum algorithms with these quantum random walks. But the problem arises when one tries to generalize now to many particles. So this would be like the quantum cellular automata, when particles can interact with each other. And so how to define this in terms of local rules? And that's actually what tried in some of these earlier papers is what they tried to do, just to try to include interactions and so on, but the rules were not that clear. So let me just introduce it in a different way. And it's motivated by this later work by Werner and the co-workers. And it's to connect it to causality. And so we all know what causality is. So it's that if I have two regions, which are space-like separated, and I do some action in B, then I will not be able to detect the action in A if the distance is sufficiently large. And right. And so this can be mathematically formulated as follows. So first of all, well, my goal here would be to define a unitary operator acting on the whole system such that it respects causality. So meaning that whenever I do an action in B, I cannot observe it in A until some later time. And I'm talking about a strict causality, not with an exponential tail, but a strict causality as it would be, for example, the case in relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay, so let's formulate this mathematically. It's relatively simple. So if I start with some initial state of the whole system, so this includes A, B, and the rest, and then I act on B, I do any action on B, and after that, I evolve with a unitary operator, that's the one that I want to characterize, then at the end should happen that if I perform a measurement in A, and this A is far away, then the outcome of this measurement should be independent of this unitary operator in B. Right, that's what it means, that in A, my measurements cannot depend on what I did in B. And so you can just, I mean, this is the same thing. So you can just represent mathematically. So you just express any expectation value of an observable in region A, no? Should be equal to this quantity. So you substitute the psi after t, xa up psi of t. And this should be independent of ub. So this should be equal to this observable here. And this should be for any ub. So it should be this result of the observable should be independent of ub and for all observables xa. And then you think a little bit about that and you see right away that basically you look at this operator here, that somehow it has to commute with ub. And if it commutes with UB, if it commutes with UB, it means that this operator that appears here has to be supported in a region only around A. So it means that if I have this operator in A and I now do in Heisenberg picture, let's say I evolve it, then it has to be supported only in a region around A, but far away from B. And in that case, that's fulfilled. So in other words, you can define causality or a unitary operator respecting causality would be the one that in the Heisenberg picture maps operators in a region on some regions that are surrounding it, but don't go away, far away, right? Okay, so that was the first concept, so causality. Now let's look at locality. It's a very much related concept. And so by locality means that if I also have a unitary operator that somehow if those two regions are not correlated initially, so for example, this region A and B are not correlated initially, and I make a unitary transformation, then they will be also not correlated after the unitary operation. That's what, I mean, it's one of the notions, possible notions of locality. And so the goal here would be also, like before, to characterize the unitary operators acting on the whole system, which keep locality, which obey locality. And so we can formulate it also mathematically, as I did before. So we say, imagine that I divide the whole space into regions, the region A on top or A bar on top and the region B down there. And imagine that my initial state is a product state between A and B, between this region and this region. That's what is written here. I start with no correlations, let's say between region A and B. And now I apply this unitary operation acting on everything. Then if I look at any correlator between A and B after this U, so if I look at any expectation value, they should be uncorrelated. So it should be after the action of U, also a product of correlation. So it should be the connected correlation function should be zero. Okay, so that's just a definition. And then you can see that's exactly what I just wrote. So you can just rewrite it and write it in a formula, yes, taking into account that this has to be true for all x and all y and so on. And you can reformulate it like that. That if you start with some state, which is a product state between some region and a bar, which contains a and the surroundings and the rest, and then you apply your unitary operator, and then you trace the region, the region in between, this region that's in between, then you have a product state. So it means that U and U dagger is able to entangle maybe the regions a bar and the complement, but it doesn't reach all the way to A. If you trace around A, this is uncorrelated. Okay, and you see that this is a very similar definition as the one that we have before, but basically that U does not create correlations, it's in this sense, but it's in the Schrodinger picture. So here we are applying U and U dagger. Okay, so now the goal of this talk would be just to take these definitions and translate them into some practical criteria. So if you give me now some unitary operator, how do I know if it fulfills this condition or not? If it's, let's say, if it keeps locality and causality, I will have some formal definitions and then show that actually these all the ones that fulfill these things can be written in terms of tensor networks, and then you can work with tensor networks and answer many questions actually that come up in the context of cellular automata. Okay, but the first thing that I want to do, so for the moment I had a very general definition, so the first thing that I want to do is to discretize space and time. So first of all, discretize space, so I will consider lattice like this one here. And this, what I say when I have a unitary operation acting, actually, I want to do it more general. So I want to have any physical action which applies to all the lattice and changes my state of the whole lattice. And this physical action is not only a unitary operator, can be the most general physical action. And you probably know that the most general physical action is described mathematically in terms of what is called a quantum channel. So this means that we will consider here is a state rho zero of the whole lattice and an action of a quantum channel. And this will change the state rho one into, the state rho zero into a state rho one, which is defined as some linear map, which is this quantum channel E acting on rho zero. So in order to continue, then I have to now define some properties of lattice and remind some properties of quantum channels because they will be important to understand the rest of the talk. Okay, so the first thing in the case of a lattice, now I'm going to talk about some regions A and whether you keep causality or locality of these regions. So there is the region A, then there will be the surrounding. So somehow in terms of causality on locality or locality, if you want, what happens is that if you start with something in region A, then it can somehow move information to some neighboring, but not far away. That's what it means, locality, and what is also behind causality. And so what I'm going to do, since this region can be at any distance or could be some fixed distance, so I'm going to block the lattice, all the spins, so putting spins together in such way, this is what is represented here, just by blocking in such a way that the range of these actions that I'm going to consider is only one. So namely, if you start with it's an operator acting in A, and then you apply this U A E dagger that I told you before, then the operator XA will be now supported around it, but only at the distance one. Okay, so this can always be done for any lattice. So this means that without loss of generality, we can consider the range to be equal to one. And then you see that I will work with regions. And so you just want to define the regions from the start. So we'll have the region A. This will be the region that I always select and that I will try to map and see what happens. Then I will call A the neighbor of this region, which is which is at the range one, so at the distance equal to one. So that's this part that is in blue. Then I will consider the boundary of the boundary. This is this small b, this green that is here, and then the rest I will call capital B. So in other words, when I choose a region A, I can distinguish four regions, the region A itself, the surrounding of the surrounding, and the rest, and I will call them A, small a, B, capital B. And the region A bar will be A and the surrounding, and the region B bar, B and the surrounding. Okay, this is just a question of notation, because I want to talk about localities, or I have to define what I mean when I'm applying operators, and they will spread a little bit. And so those are the regions, how they will spread. And also, I mean, a notion that, because I will use all the time, just wanted to mention, for if you are not familiar with that, is that I could talk about support of operators. I already say that. So what I mean, what do I mean when I say that X, the operator X, has support in A? Well, it means that it's acting on region A in some particular way, and is the identity in the rest. So it acts trivially in the other regions. So for example, an operator supported in A bar would be an operator which is acting on A bar and the rest in B bar. B bar is all the green. So it's the same thing as an operator acting in small a and A, because this is A bar, according to my definition, and the identity acting on B bar, which is a small B and B and its surroundings, let's say, and the same thing for B. Okay, so I will talk all the time about XA, XA bar, meaning that this is supported, and that's what I mean by that. Okay, so this was regarding lattices. Now, regarding quantum channels, so let me just remind you that the most general physical action can be described in terms of a linear map that maps density operators into density operator, and it has two property. It's completely positive because my resulting density operator has to be a positive operator, and it's trace preserving because it has to keep probabilities. The sum of probabilities has to be equal to one. And actually, there are different ways of representing these quantum channels. One of them is Krauss representation. So it can be shown that if you give me any channel, there exists a set of operators AK and AK, AK that fulfill this condition. These are called Krauss operators. I can't represent this the channel in this form mathematically. And also, it's important to know that you can define what is the adjoint channel. And the adjoint channel is the one in which, in this representation, A dagger and A are exchanged. So somehow the adjoint channel is like the Heisenberg picture of a channel, right? If it acts like that on density operators, it acts like that in observables. And the reason is because, I mean, this dagger, the adjoint, is referred to the Hilbert-Schmidt scalar product. So that's in the space of operators. So it means that the operator adjoint is the one that I can move from here to there, to the other side, and that's like going from the Schrödinger to the Heisenberg picture. Okay, so I will use this notation, meaning the adjoint channel, and just if you're not familiar with that, here's what I mean. You have a unitary channel, so the simplest channel when there is no environment, there is nothing, but just by unitary, then this channel is just acting as U rho U dagger, and the adjoint of the channel is U dagger XU, so it's like the Heisenberg picture again of the channel. But you can generate, and you can extend this definition, not to non-unitary channels as well. Okay, so now let's start. Now we have all the tools in order to define what are, I mean, these two notions of cellular automata that I will define, two different notions, one related to locality, one related to causality. And let's see if they are similar or not, and so on. And they will ask several questions about them. So the first one is causality preserving quantum channels. So these are the channels, actually, in which if you apply the adjoint channel to any operator that is supported in some region A, then it gives you an operator which is supported in the region A and its surrounding, right? So that's what we said before, basically. No, that I mean, we did it for unitary channels. This was the motivation of causality, but now you can extend it. And in fact, a quantum cellular automata is a unitary causality preserving quantum channel. So the definition, the standard definition of a cellular automata in these papers here, it was only for unitary operators, and they define them actually in this way. But what I'm saying here is that you can extend the definition to arbitrary channels just using here the adjoint of the channel, and it has the same meaning that you will not be able to detect in some other region whether you have done an action in the first system or not. Now we can define a locally preserving quantum channel. The same is the one that for any region, and you start with a product state. So you start the product state of the blue regions and the green regions, and you trace the boundaries, this small a and small b, these are the boundaries of both regions, then you get the product state. Okay, so you have a product state, you apply a channel, but you're still not able to create correlations between capital A and capital B. Okay, and this is what I said at the beginning before, that this, if there are no correlations initially, then there will be no correlations far away if you apply the channel, right? Okay, so we have these two definitions, one causality preserving quantum channel, another locally preserving quantum channels. And the definition is simply that for the first one, and this for the second one. This is for any X and any region A, and this is for any region A and any density operators rho A and rho B. Okay, so now what we're going to do is to translate this, I mean, a little bit the strategy is to translate these definitions into states. And this is gone through the Shchoya-Mikulski isomorphism that I'm going to explain. Then these states, we can represent them with tensor networks or whatever, and this is what we're going to show. And then we go back to the channels. So this, so let me first just mention something that is also known for quantum channels, is that you're giving a quantum channel, then there's something called time springs dilation, which tells you that the quantum channel can always be seen as you have a channel acting on state here, is equivalent to adding an ancilla in some arbitrary state, well, some state rho A and sigma A, let's say, applying a unitary operation to both, and then tracing the ancilla. Okay, so any channel, any physical action can be obtained just by adding this ancilla. So one can think that this ancilla is like an environment. So you're saying that any action in a physical system is like coupling to an environment, evolving and tracing the environment, and that's always true. So it's always possible to find that. Okay, so a channel can be viewed as an interaction with an environment. The second thing, and that's an important concept, and if you're not familiar to it, with it, then I think that this is important, is that if you give me any physical action, any channel, I can find some state, and there is an isomorphism. So I can map channels into states and states into channels. So this means that at the end, if you want to work with channels, you can, for the same price, work with states. And if you understand well states, then you will understand well what are the channels. And the idea is, this isomorphism is very simple. So if you have a channel, the way in which you build the state is the following. You take your system here. You consider a maximally entangled state with some auxiliary system here, where this maximally entangled state is just in some orthonormal basis, some state like that. And then you apply the channel to your system. And then, of course, you will get a global state of the system and the ancilla. And that's what is called choice state. It will be typically a mixed state because your channel will produce, will not be unitary. So give me a channel, you give me a channel, then this automatically defines a state. And this is called the choice state or the Shchoya-Mikulski state. What is interesting is that it's an isomorphism. So given a state, you can also define a channel. So you give me a state R, and I want to define how my channel acts on some particular density operator. The only thing that I have to do is to put here the density operator on the ancilla, well, transpose with respect to this basis, that's a technical point, and then trace the ancilla. And you can see that actually these are one-to-one mapping, and this coincides. So you replace this thing here, then you get an identity. Okay, so what is important here is to notice that, again, that given a channel, I can, for the same price, work with states. The only thing is that I have to include an ancilla. So my state will be for my system and some copy of my system. Now, if we have a lattice, like we have at the moment, you have a many-body system, then it turns out that then this definition, I mean, this Shchoya-Mikulski state, it's very simple because this maximally entangled state between the system and the ancilla can be chosen without loss of generality as a local maximally entangled state between your system and ancilla. So in other words, you have a channel acting on your system. The way of building the state is that you take a copy of each of your systems, or all your particles, and put them in a maximally entangled state with your system, and then apply the channel to the state, and then you will get a final state, and this is the Shchoya-Mikulski state. And the opposite is also true, and we will use this later on, that if I want to talk about channels, then I don't have to give you a channel. I can give you a state. And this state, in order to define a channel, has to have two properties. First of all, of course, has to be, this operator has to be positive semi-definite. And the second is that if we trace the ancillas in this state, then we get the identity. Okay, so again, so instead of talking about channels, which is sometimes complicated, it's much simpler to talk about states. These are choice states. They define the channel. So if I give you the state, they define the channel. The only thing that I have to make sure is that they are states. And the second thing is that the technical point that they're special in the sense that if you trace the ancilla, then you completely depolarize the first system. Okay. So now that we have that, this means that we can just rephrase the definition of causality preserving quantum channels in terms of the corresponding choice state. And so how do we do that? Well, you can just do it and you just rephrase it. You just have to to prove that. That's relatively simple. Is that you will have a causality preserving quantum channel if and only if the corresponding choice state fulfills that when you trace some systems, then you have a product state. Okay, this is represented here. So this is my system composed of four regions. So again, we have these four regions, A, small a, B, and B. So I represent each one by one point here, one dot here. And then I consider the choice state. So I have to put an auxiliary particle here. And then I'll have a global state. This is my state R of everything. And my state R corresponds to a causality preserving quantum channel, the ones that I wanted to define. If and only if, whenever I trace these three particles, then the rest, it's a product state. So I will stay at the end with five particles. So it should happen that the three particles A and the two particles in B have to have in a product state. And actually the state of B has to be the identity. So it's a very simple characterization in the sense that I don't have to check anymore that for every observable this happens. But I have to just, you give me the channel, I compute the choice state, and I make sure that when I trace, then I have this property, and if I can show that, then I'm done. Okay, now we can do the same thing for the locally preserving quantum channel. The condition is very similar, is that if you take the choice state, and if you trace some particles, then you get a product state. However, it turns out that it's a little bit different. So you just look at the locality preserving, then you only have to trace these two particles. And then you have to get a product state. Okay, so that's a summary of what we have written here. So we define channels that preserve causality and channels that preserve locality. And in terms of the choice state, the first ones are characterized because if I trace the three particles, if I take any region A, and trace everything else but A, but not the ancillas, then I must have a product state. And the second, the locally preserving, is the same thing, but you just have to trace the boundary. So we see that these definitions, which seemed very similar, actually, they may not be because they are not the same definition. And so now we will figure out what is kind of the right definition, and so what happens with quantum cell automata, and show the connections with tensor networks, area law, and so on. Okay, so first the connection with tensor networks. Okay, so now I think that in this audience, I don't have to talk about tensor networks. The only thing is that we have operators. We can have, for example, unitary operators. That's what we are considering, unitary operators or channels. And unitary operators can be described in terms of tensor networks. Some of them, these are what we call matrix product unitary. So it's like a matrix product state, but in which you have now two indices in each of your tensor, one corresponding to the bra and one corresponding to the ket. So this transforms, if you want, a matrix product state into another matrix product state, and can be written in terms of products of matrices with respect if you fix this index and this index. So it's like a matrix product state, but now it's an operator. Now you can also have it in higher dimensions and it would be the same. So it would be like a PEPS now, but where you have that there is a bra and a ket for each of your indices. And as we know for tensor networks, I mean, the nice thing is that if you give me these tensors, then I completely characterize what is the action of this unitary operator. And in particular, if you have a translational invariant system, then one tensor completely specifies the whole unitary operator. I'm not going to use it here, but you can also do the same thing. You can define quantum channels that are tensor networks. Now they will have four indices because they have to act on in one dimension to on matrix product density operators and so on, but I'm not going to define them. Okay, so now the question is, one question that comes up is, if I give you some tensors here, how can I make sure, or a simple tensor, how can I make sure that this is indeed a unitary operator? So how can I check by looking at the tensor if it's a local unitary operator? And it's simple to show that it fulfills this condition that we call in this paper simple, then it will be a unitary operator. And in this context where we are using that, it means that if you take any region A, its boundary, the boundary is the boundary, and the rest, and then you block and consider now these four tensors, one corresponding to the region, that whenever you take this matrix, I mean, this operator, this tensor network for U, and then you put here the U dagger, and then you multiply only these two indices, then it turns out that then you can decorrelate them. Okay, so that's a condition, and you can understand that, of course, when you, in order to be a unitary operator, when you compute U dagger, it has to be the identity. So you would put U dagger, then we can take regions and start decorrelating, and with some details, then you can show that this gives rise to a unitary operator. So in the case of matrix products, in the case of one dimension, then, I mean, it's something that you can check. You just take your tensor and check if a couple of tensors fulfill this condition, and then you can make sure that then you will have unitary operators. You can extend this definition to higher dimensions, yes, in this form, and these are called simple. Okay, so another thing is that I was not talking about the tensor network's description of channels, because what I will do is that I will use the choice state. So now I'm putting together everything that I'm saying. So I said that if I have a channel, I can describe it with a tensor network, maybe or maybe not. If I have a channel, I can describe in terms of a choice state. And this choice state is a state, so I can describe it maybe with a tensor network. So what I will do is go the second way. So if I have a channel, I will consider the choice state, and the choice state, I will see if I can describe it as a tensor network. And actually, it's very easy to show that these conditions are if and only if. So if I have the channel, I can describe it as a tensor network with some bound dimension, then this means that the choice state can be described as a tensor network with finite bound dimension or fixed bound dimension, and vice versa. So, but it will be simple to talk about choice states. Okay. So now we have definitions for two kinds of channels, right? The causality preserving, the locality preserving. Then we have choice states, which means that actually instead of talking about channels, we can talk about states, and then there is a corresponding definition. And then we have tensor networks that we know very well. Now I want to make connection between channels and tensor networks. But first I will consider unitary channels. And then, I mean, you can prove the following theorem, okay? So now restricting to channels that are unitary, then the following definitions are equivalent. So the first thing is that if it's causality preserving, or namely what is called in the literature as a quantum cellular automaton, it's also a locality preserving, and this locality preserving is causality preserving. So the locality and causality are exactly the same thing for unitary channels. And the second thing is that if you have a locality preserving causality preserving or any quantum cellular automaton, then it can be represented by a PEPU, so by a tensor network that has this property that is simple, and where the bound dimension does not depend on the size of your system, only depends on your local dimensions, your qubits or qutrits, and the coordination number. Okay, so this basically shows that the two definitions that I gave are the same for unitary channels. And the second thing is that all of them can be written efficiently in terms of tensor networks with a bound dimension that is independent of anything else. So you can define them in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, so let me tell you what is an idea of the proof. And because it uses many ideas of tensor networks, actually. So the first thing is that, okay, so you just take, you remember that we can work instead of a channel with choice state. So we take a maximally entangled state and apply adding the of a system and the ancilla. So introduce ancilla, puts them in the maximal entangled state with the system, and then act with our unitary operator only on the system. That's the choice state. Now we notice that, as I mentioned, the ancillas, this maximally entangled state can be written as maximally entangled states between each of the qubits that you have and the extra ancilla qubit that you put on the side. So you take your sides and you put next to it an additional particle, and that's locally maximally entangled, and then you apply the unitary operator on your system, not on the particle. This creates the choice state. So we have now the choice state. Then the third thing that you have to realize is that, of course, if I have a locally entangled state, so if I have a state of a system and the ancilla, then it, this is annihilated by a projector operator on the orthogonal state. So I can always define this subspace that is orthogonal to this state acting on one of the qubits and its ancilla, and define the projector onto the orthogonal subspace, and then this will always give zero. Okay, once you have that, then it's very easy to take just the sum of all projectors. The sum of all projectors kill the state because each of them annihilates the state. And now we conjugate with U and U dagger, and we define a Hamiltonian like that. And it's very easy to show that if you define it like that, and of course, H acting on my choice state, this is the choice state, then the U and the U dagger will go away. So it's like summing of the PN acting on this maximally entangled state, but we say that this is equal to zero. So indeed, this Hamiltonian is what we call a parent Hamiltonian for the choice state. It's a state that annihilates it. And it's very easy to show that this is a unique ground state of that Hamiltonian. So we have created a Hamiltonian that has a unique ground state, that is our choice state. Moreover, this Hamiltonian can be written as a sum of Hamiltonians, right? Each of these Pn is converted to this Hn. And these Hamiltonians commute among themselves because the original Pns commute, they act on different sides. And if you conjugate, they also commute. So we have a commuting Hamiltonian. And what is important also is that each of these Hn is just taking a Pn, which is acting locally, and conjugating with U and U dagger. But we know that conjugating with U and U dagger, because we have a causality preserving channel, this gives something that is local. So this Hamiltonian is local. So altogether, it tells me that my choice state is the ground state of a local Hamiltonian, unique ground state of a local frustration-free Hamiltonian that is commuting. But I mean, we showed many years ago that if this is the case, then your state can be written as a tensor network with a bond dimension that doesn't depend on the system size. And therefore, this choice state can be written efficiently as a tensor network. And therefore, you would write now the PEPU or whatever, the PEPU, then it will also be a tensor network. OK, so in other words, I mean, you can study cellular automata just by studying these matrix product unitaries, or PEPUs. One thing is that not all PEPUs are quantum cellular automata. OK, so for example, this is an example of a PEPU. You can see it right away. So it's the sum of two of them. So it's also a PEPU. However, it's not a quantum cellular automata because it doesn't fulfill the conditions. You can check it just by constructing the choice state and seeing that it doesn't correlate when you trace. So the point is that it has to be simple. So that's the condition that we mentioned. And in one dimension, we also showed that, well, we already showed some time ago, that a quantum cellular automata, a simple tensor network is equivalent to a quantum cellular automata. So what we are saying is that here it's true in any dimension. In that case, we prove it in a very different way. Okay, so now automatically, then you can see that there is this quantum cellular automata fulfill, obey area laws. And so you can define an area law for a unitary operator, like saying that if you apply to any product state, then the state that you get after that obeys an area law. So we know that an area law for a state is well defined. You take any region, and then the entanglement between the region and the rest only depends on the boundary. So now you can define an area law with respect to unitary operators, saying that if you act on product state, it will always create states that are area law. And I mean, then automatically you have that the quantum cellular automata obeys an area law, for sure. And this is because the choice state is a tensor network. The tensor network obeys that area law, and then you can just see that right away. Okay, so we have now proven that quantum cell automata in general are tensor networks, and also that then they obey an area law. Now let's go to the general channel. So now it's not half unitary, but more complex channel. And the first thing that you realize is that actually, if you have mixed states, then these two definitions are different. So causality preserving and locality preserving are not the same. And that's kind of obvious, because you remember this was the definition for the causality. This was the definition of the locally preserving. But you see that this definition, the set of all R fulfilling that, is a convex set. So you sum two different R's, still fulfill this condition, because you will have that the trace of some probability P1 and some probability P2, let's say you mix two choice states, then this will be like a complex combination, but it will be, you can take a common factor identity, so it will be fulfilled. However, here it's not true, so this is not convex. So right away, you can think of, let's take this example. This example is a trivial channel with probability 1/2, doesn't do anything, and with probability 1/2 applies a local unitary operator each of the states. So this state, according to the definition, is causality preserving, however, is not locality preserving. And what you see is that this state, so you talk in the language of quantum information, and you want to implement this practically, you need classical communication. That's the difference between these two. You see that indeed, in the definition, there was a difference, not for unitary, but whenever you have non-unitary, then you show that they are different. Okay, so now we can consider more channels. So let me just write some other possible channels that are mixed. Now, one of them would be factorized channels. So you see, for unitary channels, of course, if you apply to XA times YB, then you can put the identity in between, and then you can write that some channel, or some unitary channel acting on A and some unitary acting on B. But this is not necessarily true for you have mixed channels, so you have quantum channels in general. So you can define the subset of the ones that will fill that, you can then factorize channels. Then tensor network channels are the ones that by definition can be written as tensor networks. And there are the Steinsprung relation channels. Those are the ones that can obtain with the environment by acting with a quantum cellular automata. So, I mean, don't worry so much, but you can define very naturally some other definition of channels. And then you can find that this is the structure of all the channels. So the most general ones are this causality preserving. Then you have the locally preserving quantum channels. Then you have the tensor networks. And then you have this dilation, the Steinsprung dilation, so the ones that can be written with Steinsprung dilation. And you have this, the factoring, the ones that can be factored. So one can show, and I will not show here, that the locally preserving are the same as the one that can be factorized. But not all tensor networks can be written as locally preserving, and not locally preserving can be written as tensor networks. And the ones that are the Steinsprung relation, yes, they can do that. And I mean, the way that you prove this disjointness, so for example, that there exists some channel here, which is a tensor network, but it's not locally preserving, is that you build some examples. So the first example could be the one that I gave you before. It's very easy to show that this is a trivial tensor network. So the choice state is a tensor network, or the channel can be written as a tensor network with fixed bond dimension. However, as we said before, I mean, this is not locally preserving. So this means that indeed, I mean, they are not the same. Okay, now you can have another construction. So imagine that I have a state, and I construct a state, a pure state for the moment. I will build a channel based on some extra construction of a state. Imagine that I construct a state that fulfills a volume law. And this, what I do it is the following. So I take a product state in which I take one of the qubits in my lattice, and I entangle to one that is far away, the next one to one that is far away, such a way that everybody is entangled to something that is far away. This doesn't fulfill an area law, and therefore it cannot be efficiently described in terms of a tensor network. Now, so it's not a tensor network. So now you can take the coefficients that are defined by this tensor network and build a channel with them. And it's very simple to build a channel. And then you can easily show that, I mean, you define the choice state, sorry, with these coefficients, that you can always define a choice state, that it cannot be written as a tensor network, and that, for example, is here. okay, this one here, then if you use the definition, I mean, the criterion that I use for choice state, if you trace something as a product state, you can check that it's a product state. So this is how you show that this is of this sort. And I mean, this way, finding examples that you can, or proving equalities, then you can find the structure that I mentioned before. Okay, now you can also build, now what about the area law? Well, the, regarding the area law, and I'm finishing with that. So then you can define now, you say that the quantum channel obeys an area law if acting on a product state, then the state that it remains obeys the area law with respect to the mutual information. And what you can prove then is that this locally preserving obey an area law, but the other one, causality preserving, do not obey the area law. So this is done through an example. I don't have time to do that, but it's actually very simple. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about classification of states and index theorems for these cellular automata. I don't have to talk about that. Let me just say that now, in the same way that you classify phases, you can classify phases of unitaries, you can classify phases of choice states, and it turns out that they are not the same. And in fact, you can build, there is a systematic construction of channels based on some construction in quantum information called locally maximal entangled state that allows you now to prove that, for example, to construct your local unitaries that have topological order, that have different properties, and then it gives a very complex set of unitary operators that can act apart from quantum cellular automata. So now there are many other, and so that's actually, what we're doing at the moment. So let me finish. So what we did is that we extended quantum cellular automata to channels with two different definitions, causality preserving, locality preserving. We connect them with tensor networks and with area laws. And this is the part that I didn't talk about, which is we classified quantum cellular automata, but also other tensor networks, just using this construction from quantum information theory. Okay, with that, I'm finished. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Ignacio. Thanks for a nice talk. Are there any questions? So maybe I can start. So I have two questions. The first one is you gave a characterization of MPOs that are unitaries in terms of this simplicity criteria. Would that also hold if the MPO was only an isometry and not a unitary?
Okay, so because it's a difficult question, because it may happen. I mean, I would say, if it's an isometry and it's a tensor network, it means that there is a unitary that is a tensor network, or you can just project the final state into some particular state, right? Because it maps different dimensions. However, I don't know if it's true. That if you give me an isometry that is a tensor network, that I can find a unitary that is also a tensor network such that it gives rise to this isometry. If this was true, then I would go that way. I would build this tensor network, and since it has to be unitary, it has to fulfill this simplicity, so I could check it. But you know, I mean, there are many cases, and it may well happen that actually there exist isometries that whenever you project and you get a tensor network, but for the unitary, they are not. So they don't have, I mean, the bond dimension would grow indefinitely. So I don't know what is the answer.
And my second question was, you just didn't get time to mention the index, the indexes classification of these MPUs. Can it be said in words? What's the difference between MPUs, two MPUs that have a different index?
Okay, so let's say, I mean, there is a notion which is quantum circuits that we understand very well. And so one can ask, the first question is, if you have a quantum circuit, this is a finite depth circuit, quantum circuits, or a set of unitaries acting like in quantum computing, and whether this is a quantum cellular automata, and indeed it's a quantum cellular automata, but there are quantum cellular automata that cannot be written as circuits. And these are the ones that have an index. There is a topological number that defines them. And the simplest example is the one that makes a shift to the right, right? So it translates to the right. You cannot write it as a quantum circuit. I mean, well, finite depth. You can define it of a very large depth, no, but not a finite depth. So this is a quantum cellular automata. And so there was a theorem that actually that explained that in one dimension, then you have an index, and this classifies all the quantum cellular automata. But now you can include also symmetries. So what happens to the index? You have to preserve also some symmetries, and then you have like SPT phases for quantum cellular automata. Actually, this is something that we did some time ago. And now you can go to higher dimensions. And in higher dimensions, the situation is much more complex because you can have other things. And so you can have, for example, topological order. And so you can have some tensor network which cannot be deformed. Let's say cannot be even deformed to a quantum cellular automata. It has a finite one dimension, and that it possesses topological order in the sense that if applied to a product state, it can create a topological order state. And so with this formalism that we deploy here, I mean, you can do that. You can actually, I mean, prove and find, classify, et cetera, et cetera. That's the last part that I wanted to talk about.
Okay, thanks. Are there any other questions?
Yes, so maybe I have a question concerning the last comment of Ignacio. So there was a paper like a few years ago from Hastings and Fitkovsky and a few other people where they indeed developed or constructed some cellular automaton in three dimensions, as far as I remember, that that had some properties that it was a cellular automata, but it's nevertheless it could not give rise to kind of Hamiltonians that with commuting terms. And so, where does that fit in your kind of classification?
Well, I mean, it tells that indeed these quantums. I mean, what they build is something that is either a quantum cellular automata that cannot be represented with a finite depth circuit, not even with shifts. I mean, it's not that in two dimensions, it's any quantum cell automata has exactly the same properties like the one dimension. So basically are finite depth circuits plus shifts. In three dimensions, this was not shown. And so in that paper, what they showed that either they have an example for that, or they have an example in two dimensions for fermions. It's either of them. So what we show is actually that in both cases, this could be described efficiently by a tensor network. And the part with the topological order is that actually there is a quantum cellular automata. So what we can build are some unitary operators that are PEPUs, let's say, that have topological order, cannot be deformed into any quantum cellular automata. So that's different from what they presented, as far as I understand.
Yeah, good, thanks.
More questions? All right, if not, I would like to thank Ignacio again on everyone's behalf. Thanks, Ignacio.
Thanks.
And let's reconvene in maybe 5 minutes, just take a 5-minute break.